Coming up on Life is a Festival.
How do we harmonize the ongoing different policy projects, which we can get into, religious, personal, medical, decriminalized, like there's been this kind of sense that you have to just choose one and then move forward with it. And I'm really starting to become resistant to that because I actually feel like if we're going to move forward in a just way where everyone comes along, you actually need multiple points of entry for different kinds of people for their own cosmology. This isn't a zero-sum game. We're all trying to figure this out together. Let's just like be humble about that and try, make room for failure, recognize the actual or perceived urgency, and give each other grace as we move forward. And people will continue to fall through the cracks until we, quote unquote, solve this problem. Like, we're not going to be able to save everyone. And that's a hard thing to say. It's a hard thing to feel. And it's a really hard thing to watch. But I haven't figured out another way to do it. I haven't figured out what the magic pill is. And it's definitely not psilocybin.
Well, hey there, friend. Welcome to Life is a Festival. I'm your host, as always, Eamon Armstrong. So today on the show, I am speaking with an old friend and someone whose work I admire greatly. Ismail Lorido Ali is the Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And we sat down at the Horizons Conference in Oregon this year to discuss psychedelic legalization. This is a conversation we've wanted to have for a while, and it was so fun for me because I got to learn so much about Izzy, about his work, and we really did a deep dive not only on legislation around psychedelics, but the philosophy around the different pathways to legalization in the U.S., which will be kind of a state-by-state piecemeal sort of experimental thing like we do in a federalist system. And those pathways are the decriminalization movement, medicalization, religious exemption, and legal adult use. And we'll get into all of those today. The first half of the conversation, however, is dedicated to Ismail himself. And his life journey is very interesting and gives you a beautiful insight into his philosophy around legalization and why he has such a good toolkit to get us there. So we open with Ismail's cultural identity and his spiritual journey from Islam to the rave scene. And the way that Izzy talks about Islam is deeply refreshing and elucidating for someone like myself who doesn't have that much information about Islam, truly. After that, we get into this exploration of queerness and gender identity, which has been near and dear to my heart and something that Izzy and I have really bonded on. We talk about his work in drug policy reform and his journey to becoming a lawyer for MAPS. And then we get into the key paths to legalization and his philosophy around each. We discuss California's SB 519, Colorado's Natural Medicine Health Act, which goes to voters this month, and Oregon's Bill 109, which legalizes and regulates adult use of psilocybin in that state. And this is very exciting, but it's also nuanced. So tune in to that if you're interested in driving up to Oregon and doing some mushrooms. We conclude our conversation with an invitation to psychedelic entrepreneurs and Izzy's personal philosophy on why life is a festival. So, as MAPS Director of Policy and Advocacy, Ismail advocates to eliminate barriers to psychedelic therapy and research, develops and implements legal and policy strategy, and supports MAPS governance, nonprofit, and ethics work. Lots of work at MAPS for Izzy. Ismail earned his JD at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law in 2016 after receiving his bachelor's in philosophy from California State University, Fresno. Ismail has previously worked for the ACLU of Northern California's Criminal Justice and Drug Policy Project and Berkeley Law's International Human Rights Law Clinic. Ismail is licensed to practice in the state of California and is a founding board member of the Psychedelic Bar Association. He also currently serves on the board of the Sage Institute, contributes to Chacruna Institute's Council for the Protection of Sacred Plants, and participates on the Advisory Council for the Ayahuasca Defense Fund. Ismail is passionate about setting sustainable groundwork for a just, equitable, and generative post-prohibition world. What a guy. All right, here we go. Here's Izzy.
Ismail Lorido
Ali.
Yes.
Welcome to Life is a Festival.
So happy to be here.
This has been a long time coming. Let me just first say, I don't say this all the time. I don't know if I really say this. I really admire you. Really admire you. I feel like you are one of a fresh generation of taking the torch. We've got our Rick Doblins and people who've been the old guard warriors and working on this for a while.
Right.
But people like yourself, Liana, there's lots of people. I don't want to name tons of people, but there's just this kind of like wave. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who kind of grew up in the rave scene. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's an interesting starting place for us because the rave scene, for me when I was younger, was community for people who didn't have community.
Yeah.
It was like a really good outcast kind of community. Yeah. And not only did you get people who were weird like you, right, but you got the drugs, which were suddenly like breaking down barriers and making you feel good and making you realize you didn't feel good most of the other time. And you got some costumes, some pageantry, some music, blessings to the rave scene.
Truly. No, I love that. And it's funny because in my talk yesterday and regularly when I try to speak publicly about this stuff, I usually try to give a shout out to that aspect of the underground. Because while it seems like, and it's really exciting that a lot of the conversation around psychedelics now is focused on healing and trauma and these very, very important topics, that is not how most people, at least for many, many, many years, actually approach psychedelics for the first time. So I definitely, exactly as you said, growing up first generation, multicultural, multiracial in the US post 9/11 era, I was 11 when 9/11 happened and was politically socialized in like the Bush years. The NSA, illegal surveillance, the Patriot Act. I was marching against the wars in Iraq in 2002, 2003. And it was first that kind of politically socialized or radicalized me. And then shortly after, to your point, realizing that I was experiencing this kind of existential malaise about everything, found drugs and the underground and rave culture. And that was really the beginning of my self-actualization independent of my ancestral cultural context. And over the many years, I've linked those things together. But for a long time, it was an escape from what felt like so many expectations and assumptions about my identity, which, you know, maybe some of them were carried from my family or those traditions, but a lot of it were also kind of imposed on me by like the American cultural paradigm as a young person in the early 2000s. So I started kind of throwing raves with friends, you know, as a 16, 17 year old, getting in lots of trouble, having a lot of good times, and kind of uniting the misfits and the weirdos under some strange banner with a really good beat.
You said it was over many years later on that you kind of wove those two together. I wonder, is there a way of telling that story now with the perspective of having done that work of integrating those pieces? You recently published a piece in Double Blind, which I loved. And it was interesting. That piece came across my Instagram feed by quotes from it that didn't reference you. Mm-hmm. So there were people who had read it and were quoting it and kind of passing it around. And when I read it, I liked it, but I didn't know it was you until until I went in and actually read it. And I was like, oh man,
There's
a lot that I didn't actually know about you and about your ancestral cultural context, which is quite varied and a really interesting blend of different influences.
Yeah.
And I can imagine just reading the article and thinking about just what it is to grow up in America, that the process of weaving different identities must have been pretty overwhelming for someone who was 11 to 17. But in hindsight, it does make a lot of sense that those things have woven together and that you found rich beauty in Islam, for example, that actually directly relates to your work in psychedelics, which a lot of people wouldn't be able to put those two together.
Completely. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think I maybe even mentioned this in the article. So I was raised like in an environment where both because of the 9/11 stuff and the cultural context, I actually, even though I wasn't really sure what I believed as a young person, I kind of maybe even reactively like clung on to the identity of a Muslim because I felt like I was being attacked. So even when I was agnostic and didn't really know what I believed in a spiritual sense, I like stuck to that because I felt like I had a political commitment to that identity and to show whatever the world that it's not all what you're seeing in the news. And yet I was also definitely in my initial kind of exploration, both with substances and the rave scene, I initially was trying to, I think, escape some of that because I definitely didn't have the language for it at the time, but my own experience of like gender and love and relationships that felt so expansive in a mystical sense, even through the Islamic mystical lens, but as taught by a somewhat calcified, patriarchal, institutionalized tradition, which is not unique to Islam. made me feel like it was something I had to escape from. And it's interesting because I think that over the course of now 18 years or so, since probably this process started, the kind of coming home has not been coming home to the version of Islam that I thought I was being taught as a young person. It's actually to like a self-generated understanding. And I don't say that to say that I generated it, but it's something that was kind of created and formed through bits and pieces of learnings over time that kind of coalesced back into where I started in some ways, but with a whole new lens. And I bring the queerness aspect into it because my experience of like gender in particular has been highly informed by my relationship with psychedelics. And it was and remains hard for me to reconcile that if there is a creator, whether it's Great Spirit or the Great Mystery, Allah, however we call it, that our like human desires and needs in like a basic sense are even important enough to that entity to decide what we do for eternity after. You know, that concept was just so absurd to me. And so coming back to it has really brought me back into not a materialist, but certainly like a real life action version of it, which is like, it's actually so much more about how you show up relative to your identity and experience. And to your point, it was, and maybe sometimes still is, quite chaotic and complex to be me and to navigate all of that. But I feel like I've had a lot of spaciousness and support, both from plants and also from people, to kind of feel now, I can say, you know, at 32 years old, probably 20 years after this process started in some ways, really at home in myself. But it took a long, long time to get there.
You seem at home in yourself.
Thank you.
You do. You seem at home in yourself. So after 9/11, mm-hmm. feeling attacked, you leaned into your Muslim identity. Your mother's from Colombia.
Yeah.
Were you much influenced by her spiritual traditions, either through Catholicism mm-hmm. or perhaps any sort of indigenous uh-huh. traditions came through her side of the family that also kind of influenced your perspective at that time?
My mother left or was asked to leave, depending on who you ask, the Catholic Church when she married my dad, who was Muslim. And so my house was, well, my dad, I like to say he's devout, but not dogmatic. And he was always really spacious about kind of the multi-religious experience. But we were raised Muslim, and most of my like close cultural religious context was Muslim. So I feel like a lot of what I got from my mom's side of the family, which is a very Colombian thing, is actually like what I now see as like the spiritual practice of celebration and celebration through everything, through pain, through suffering, through sorrow, and also through beauty and joy. So those things linked at some point. But yeah, I think like the initial religious heuristic I received was really Islam and like that kind of framework. But on an interpersonal and community level, I feel like I got a lot of her, even if it wasn't through like the Catholic lens, which is how she was raised. My mom did eventually convert to Islam probably like 10 years after she married my dad. And he was always really spacious about it. And it's funny because it's kind of a little bit of a trope. I think this is probably true of other religions too, but it's a little bit of a trope that the converts are always like more diligent mm-hmm, than the people who yeah. grew up in the culture. And my mom was always very, very serious with us about like how we practiced in our religion. So I would say I did get a lot from her and from her lineage, but not specifically in the religious sense, except for maybe because a lot of my friends growing up, because of their interreligious experience, were also mixed. So I was around a lot of people who were in households with multiple religious experiences simultaneously. So that was even more significant than Islam or Catholicism or anything else. It was like multiple truths can be held at the same time. And that is like the core fundamental thing that kind of all of the other cultural stuff builds on top of.
I was raised straight atheist.
Straight atheist.
Straight uh-huh. atheist, yeah. My parents took me to like a Unitarian church when I was really little because they felt they should expose me to something. Mm-hmm. And a little boy asked me if I believed in God. And I said, no, that doesn't make any sense. And he mm-hmm. said, well, then you worship Satan.
Ooh.
And I was like, well, I don't believe in Satan either. And it was this weird sort of like existential bullying moment. Mm. And I was like, I am done with you people. Like this is, and at the time, you know, as we always tend to be, not we always, but I think there's an inclination to feel some degree of righteousness around your belief system.
Yeah, for sure.
And particularly atheism. There's a certain sort of like, well, I'm an intellectual. But what you were just describing around, you know, having those multiple cultural contexts, mm-hmm. that's a bounty. That's a blessing. There's so much to draw mm-hmm. on there. Mm-hmm. And for me, my connection to Islam is really through Sufi poets.
Yeah,
I mean, that's,
for sure.
And many psychedelic people are like, well, if Islam is the words of Hafiz yeah. and the devotion to the beloved, yeah. then yeah, give me Islam and that can,
on. Yeah,
yeah and that can pair nicely yeah. with my psilocybin
for sure.
Monday hike, yeah, you know, like that, right. that all aligns. You said a little while ago that the Islam that you believed you were mm. learning about as a child is not the Islam that mm. you experience now. Do you consider mm. yourself Muslim now? And how do you see it now with your psychedelic context, with the inclusion of queerness?
Yeah, no, I bet we could talk about this for 3 hours, but the short answer is yes, I do identify as Muslim. And I never stopped, even through all of the everything that went down. And the word Muslim, it's used to describe a practitioner of Islam. Islam just means the way of peace. And the word Muslim means one who submits, and usually like one who submits to the way of peace. And that framework, which comes with a particular set of what we might call, and I mean this non-disparagingly, like religious mythology, stories and archetypes and so on, was definitely something that was evocative for me and is evocative for people learning Islam, but was also confusing to me, like the particular ways of the stories that I was taught. And it wasn't the fault of the teachers or the framework, but there's a particular thing that happens, and I wonder what it would be like and what it's like in other countries, but there's a particular thing, especially in a place like the United States, where the pressure of cultural assimilation is so strong that people who immigrate here, I saw this a lot in the Muslim community, would latch onto kind of almost calcified versions of their own beliefs to hold on to something from where they came from. And you see, while, you know, it's a little bit more nuanced than this, you do see some level of evolution. Maybe not always progressivism, but certainly evolution in places where Islam is not just the religion that people are practicing, but it's also the cultural context, because kind of everyone's in it together. In the U.S., especially in the post-9/11 era, there was a sense of like, we have to hold on to this or else like we'll be swallowed up by the American industrial machine. So I think that when I talk about the version of Islam that I was taught, it's for sure to some extent informed by the usual like ABCs of political hierarchy, patriarchy and colonialism and political buying and resources, all of which are political human things that get injected into religious practice all over the world. But I think that the version of Islam that I was taught had a lot of that kind of reactiveness in it. And I think this is true of a lot of first generation people whose parents are just trying to hold on to something from their own tradition. They just don't want to lose it. And in trying to hold on to it, it kind of gets rigid, or it can feel that way. So when I came back to Islam, in many ways, kind of hilariously, through the words of Hafiz and Rumi and these poets, where I was like, what do you mean this is the same tradition? And I've always felt my dad was actually very Sufi. My dad introduced me to Taoism when I was like 14. And he's like kind of a, I don't know if he would say this, but I experience him as kind of like a Taoist Muslim, like very, very in this like spaciousness around mysticism. Increasingly so as we get to know each other as adults and so on too. But the version of Islam that I feel like I came home to, you could say, and what felt so gratifying about staying with this identity as like one who submits to the way, to the will of the universe, was that it did have many of the archetypes of the stories that I grew up with, of like graciousness and gratitude and well-being and service and all, and like social and political, you know, like Islam is actually a very politically engaged practice. It's, you engage with the world around you. There's a version of it that can be kind of ascetic, away from everything, but that's not really the way that I was taught. So coming back to it, it was like, oh, there is this level of engagement with the world around me, but it doesn't have to be on the terms of the particular tradition that I was introduced to or exposed to, and that it could be kind of with the words and the experience on my own terms. And one thing I'll say, which is maybe a bit controversial, is Islam at its most basic is the belief in one creator, a singular creator. So it, in some ways it was a reaction to kind of polytheism. It was like there's actually one entity there. That and the belief that the Prophet Muhammad is the last prophet, the last person who had a message. And there's a lot of kind of nuances and details to that. But whether or not I believe that Muhammad is the last prophet or was the last person to carry the message of God in that clear sense, and whether or not I believe the Quran, which is the words through the prophet that kind of form the kind of basis of the religious practice, I do see is maybe not Islam, depending on your definition, but certainly being a Muslim as that and more than that, as also including the kind of pre-Islamic mystical practices from where like the kind of Sufi lineage continued to emerge, in the same way you see like Gnostic Christianity and the Kabbalah and like these different kind of mystical traditions that were incubated and remained. You see this also in paganism and Christianity in Europe, where it's like there's kind of these like strongholds of these like mystical traditions within these larger religious structures that are both separate from, but also intricately involved in the evolution of those spiritual practices. So I feel like what I came back to was, oh, there's actually this like core mystical tradition here that's been there all along, that gets told through allegory and story and mythology, but actually at its core is about like, how do we be with each other as humans on this very confusing planet, trying to make some sense of it? So I think that a lot of it came back to like, how do we make sense of what's going on here? And this particular framework was and remains resonant for me and is just one shade of a much larger conversation too.
Well, and as our listeners will hear further on in the conversation, this directly relates to how you view psychedelic legislation.
Definitely.
which is so great, which is so great. So I want to presence that because we are going to be getting into the state of psychedelic legislation. But before we move more into the realm of psychedelics, I would be remiss, considering my own relationship to the world and what I think is interesting, not to take a moment to speak on queerness.
Yeah.
And for me, I find sexuality to be psychedelic. My sexuality is very psychedelic, mm-hmm. perhaps because of psychedelics, mm-hmm. and perhaps my experience of the psychedelic mm-hmm. world is very much about what is mystical about the erotic. Mm-hmm. Before we started recording, you presenced that queerness is an ongoing inquiry for
yeah.
you. And to me, I think that almost defines queerness yeah. for me. Like to say, for me, and again, I think when we talk of sexuality and gender, it's very helpful to say, for me,
yeah,
this is the thing. For me, a label like gay or mm-hmm. straight or even bisexual feels like a sort of landing point. Like, I right. am this, yeah. and you can expect this from me.
Yeah.
What I love about queerness is you don't know what to expect from me.
Totally.
We'll see what happens. I might be entering a fairly femme period, yeah. or it's almost like an artist with their work. There's a spaciousness. I love that you've been using spaciousness to describe your father. There's a spaciousness for things to shift and evolve and mm-hmm. an openness to that, mm-hmm. which to me is very psychedelic.
Definitely.
And so from that perspective, you mentioned queerness in relation to Islam in the Double Blind article. I'm not aware if you've spoken publicly around your perspective on queerness, mm-hmm. but I wanted to give you a little space here, even just a little workshop, mm-hmm. If you want to share a little bit about what queerness has meant for you in the context of mm-hmm. both mysticism and psychedelics and just your way of being in the world.
Yeah, I'll start with a little bit of background. Well, actually, I'll start with this. So I was at Boom Festival this year, which was spectacular. It was such a beautiful kind of reconvening of the global psytrance community and so much more. But it was awesome because I was at I think in 2018, the last edition, I think that Boom, maybe, I don't know exactly how it went down, but I think there was a sense that there was a need for more kind of queerness at Boom, whatever that looked like. And maybe that's because of the heteronormativity of Portuguese or European culture. Maybe that was because of who was attracted to the scene at the time. I don't know. So what that meant is that in 2022, this year, there was a lot of kind of conversations about and workshops about and play shops about like queerness and like both gender and sexuality exploration at Boom. And I had this moment where there was this amazing workshop. I think it was like a Cuddle 101, which being from the Bay Area, I was kind of there just to observe because we've gotten lots of those there. But where it was this amazing group based out of Berlin, I think, called Skinship. And they did this fantastic like, cuddle consent workshop. And they asked at some point, like, who in the room is considering themselves queer? It was so interesting because I stood up and I realized as I was standing up that I had never, I've been really hesitant to use that term to describe myself, primarily because I've seen it as kind of like you said, a landing place for people who have felt marginalized by their sexuality or gender expression. And because of my many privileges, because I pass as a very cis person, because I'm quite masculine in a lot of my kind of baseline presentations, and because like I've developed enough of my identity that I don't feel the fear that I did when I was younger, which I'll get to in a second, I was like, oh, wow, like, am I really saying this about myself? And maybe I'd said it in my head and I hadn't talked about it publicly, really, even though anyone who knows me knows that there's something going on. And it was really cool because it was like I almost surprised myself with my identification of that after being really resistant for a very long time because I see myself as a friend and ally, quote unquote, and in solidarity with my many friends who I always felt were queerer than I am. And I was like, I actually got to be the person in between them and the kind of...
I'm not queer enough, so I'm an ally.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, literally that.
There's some like binary between those
exactly,
two positions.
Exactly. Exactly. So I start by saying that because zooming way back, like as I was going through this whole exploration with Islam and psychedelics as like an early mid teenager, the other thing that was happening was what I now know as an exploration around gender and identity. And what I experienced at the time being like a pretty femme and flamboyant teenager who like liked wearing makeup and liked performing a certain level of aesthetic femme, whatever, and like playing in that realm, got called a lot of names and got bullied even by people who I considered friends. Although I didn't know that, didn't really realize that at the time what was happening based on that like perception of my performance. And so for many years, as a person who's been socialized as male, the pressure to not be gay, to not be homo, you know, like, especially as a teenager, especially in kind of like an athletic kind of machismo culture, which I was definitely surrounded by, so strong, and I had so much fear. I was like, oh my God, what if I'm this marginalized? What if I'm not only Muslim and multiracial and small and skinny and all these other things, but what if I'm also something else, you know? Yeah. And so that was like really torturous is a strong word, but it really preoccupied me for many, many years. And it wasn't until, and it's funny because even at the time I was meeting people who I now know are like non-binary or trans, but I don't think that I didn't, and maybe they didn't even have that language at the time. Maybe they did, but I wasn't present enough with it to understand. So I say all that to say that like when I got a little bit older and started to understand not just the sexual identity thing, but the gender identity thing, it was like, it was literally like someone poured cold water on my flaming heart. Like I was like, holy wow, that's what's going on here. It was like this exploration that my experience of queerness has not been so much in my relationship of attraction to other people. That's actually kind of been a side note. What's been way more present is my own experience of what I now know to be like a gender identity conversation. So experiencing and realizing that there was something bigger than just, oh, am I gay or am I straight? Like you said, like this binary. And that in fact, what I was experiencing was a non-binariness of my own experience. Like that was such a liberating place. And that happened probably, I don't know, it may be initially in my late teens or early 20s and really solidified in like my mid-early 20s. But it's now taken, like I said, I'm 32. It's now taken probably like at least 4 or 5, maybe 6 or 7 years to, and while I've admitted it, maybe that's the wrong word, but framed it to myself that way. And like I said, everyone who knows me knows that there's like more than just the usual whatever socialization going on. And this is like, from a very young age, people could see it or experience it. I actually feel like I never, and I feel like I never have and never really had to like come out as a person who didn't experience life as entirely like male or masculine, because it was just so obvious all the time to anyone around me. And it really felt so to me. So all that to say that like where I'm at now is kind of like in this, I think, much more playful and less pressured understanding, partially because of what you said. Like I think that part of my like reticence or resistance to identifying as queer is the fact that like, what does it really mean? And that's actually now I see as like a really beautiful sandbox instead of this like thing to be afraid of, and have continued to like be in my own understanding of what is gender. I heard the term a couple of years ago, because you know, there's like a gajillion terms to describe people and maybe it changes every day. And I've used the term gender fluid a lot because it feels like the most like actually experientially true. But I met someone, I don't know, it was a few years ago. Someone told me that they experienced life as being gender relaxed.
Ooh.
And I loved that.
Wow.
I love that.
I love that.
Because I was like, yeah, it's like, it's not that my experience of gender isn't a huge factor in my life, because it definitely is. And it has been, especially in people's perception of me, especially as a younger person, but also now. But it feels like, initially it felt like something that like my human pet, my like human body self needed to deal with, when it was like, is this about sexual attraction? And as I've gotten more into my own spiritual practice, it's actually much less about my physical sexual attraction or identity. It's much more about like my inner world and like how I feel like I'm navigating reality, which maybe you can describe as like a spectrum between masculine and feminine, but I actually feel like that's the binary version of the non-binary experience. And I think there's something beyond that. I don't like using the term post-gender because I feel like it kind of diminishes the very real fact and reality of the gender experience and how it affects people's lives. But the idea of seeing gender as an expression of like a material or spiritual aspect that's just one of these many things, and it kind of does diminish its power. But for me, that's empowering instead of, I don't know, oppressive.
I like the idea of an emergent constellation. I don't personally desire to be post-gender because I like gender, and right. I like landing in sort of strong presentations at different times in my life.
Yeah, that's real.
At one Burning Man, I spent some time as cowboy princess, and it was like cowboy is like this John Wayne masculinity, and princess is to me like the most sort of like tender feminine sort of thing that I got. What does it mean to be both? And to, you know, cowboy hat and a tutu, and what does that mean? And I think so much around these boundary pushing explorations are the liberation of from fear and the liberation of feeling bound. You use the expression, did you say cold water on my flaming heart?
Yeah.
Did you say flaming heart?
I said flaming. I mean, I guess it's like Flaming implies that it was awesome. It was like difficult and challenging. But yes, that is what I said.
Well, it was so poetic. And what's interesting for me is that my bully name was Flamin' Amen.
Of course.
Yeah. So when people bullied me for being feminine, i.e. gay, i.e. the worst thing you could be in the early 90s in America as a man, it was Flamin' Amen.
Wow.
And just the cadence of it. And now it's like, that's, I could drive an art car with that name. You know, like now it's a whole different matter. But like, of all the things, that's what stung the most. And so just now, when you were like, cold water on my flaming heart, and I was just like, oh, it's so poetic, touches my own kind of queer journey.
So my nickname is Izzy, and most people think of it, and it is because like when I was in fourth grade in Fresno, California, most people couldn't even say Ismail. They would say Ishmael, which is a beautiful name, and it's really a Hebrew, not Arabic. So now when I hear that, I say it's Ismail with a soft S. It's Arabic, not Hebrew. I love Hebrew and I love that history, but it's Arabic is where the name comes from. But what people don't know is that when I was in fourth grade, the joke was that my name wasn't just Izzy, but it was short for Izzy Mail. And my name is Ismail.
Whoa.
So, and what's funny is that at the time, I don't really remember, like, that was in fourth grade. That was really pre what I experienced as bullying. Like that to me, I didn't experience. And I, even in retrospect, didn't feel like them challenging my masculinity as a four-year-old. I think that it was like, but there was definitely something in the field that maybe gave rise to that. And I've really lovingly reclaimed that. And most people don't know that story. And most people know me as Izzy. But it's definitely in line with that. And actually, I want to say one more thing, which is, it's so funny to talk about Cowboy Princess, because my version of that exact archetype with almost the exact same outfit is the butterfly wrangler. It's like imagine like a cowboy, wow, but like with butterfly wings and a tutu and like a little rope and being like, I'm out here butterfly wrangling like SpongeBob style.
Do we need to have like a Burning Man play date?
I think so.
I feel like we just need to round up a lot of the, a lot of the gender exploring folks with their different avatars and have a sort of some hootenanny at Burning Man, which is a great place for that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, this is... I'm so happy to have this particular conversation with you. And I have to be a little self-disciplined as an interviewer, because I could just keep going into the queerness and psychedelics and that sort of thing. But these explorations haven't been the only feature in your life. And and your professional exploration is also really poignant and has led you to the moment we're in right now. We're both together in Oregon at the Horizons Northwest Conference. And you were mentioning yourself, you've been speaking for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I'm impressed by your exploration of self and your comfort in speaking of it. You're also holding a lot of very important technical information, and you are speaking passionately to an audience that is quite disparate on a subject that is extremely emergent. And so I'd love to just take a moment to talk about how you got to the place where you're the Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. I know you've worked in drug policy reform. Mm-hmm. You have quite an impressive professional CV to at 32 to be in such a strong leadership role in this movement. And I think the mystical, queer, psychedelic underpinnings of that are foundational and important. Mm-hmm. But there's also... you played the game and you are playing ball with big forces, and that's a lot to hold. So yeah, I'd just like to take a moment to talk about that journey as we jump into our conversation about what legalization looks like now.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a total continuation of our last conversation, because that same political socialization, surveillance in the NSA and the Patriot Act, that kind of the marches and the protests as a really young teenager, also are what got me interested in the political process. And it wasn't until I was probably in college, and really even by the time I got to law school, that I thought that for a long time, I thought that my professional kind of career was going to be, I knew it was going to be something that I was really passionate about, because I couldn't bear the thought of doing anything else. And I thought for a long time that I was going to be working in kind of the area of like civil liberties and international diplomacy and peacekeeping and this kind of these larger arcs. And maybe eventually I'll go back in that direction. It wasn't really until I was in high school, I was arrested for a possession and paraphernalia charge when I was 17 while I was a senior, not expelled because I was a super high achieving student, in part due to my parents' persistence, but that I started to like kind of get the inkling that there was like, I knew there was injustice, but that I could do something about the injustice when it came to like the way that we thought about drugs. And earlier you were asking about my mom's religious experience and whether or not that influenced me. And what's funny is that while that, like I said, was partially influential, but there were other aspects, when I realized, which was probably in my late teens, that my experiences that I was seeking with substances was not so far away. My mother left Colombia in 1986, and her family left in part because of the violence related to the cocaine wars that were happening there. And actually, just last night, I learned from a friend that up until the Iraq War, which I cut my teeth protesting against, the largest military budget expenditure for the United States was in Colombia and for Colombia to fight the war on drugs, coca eradication, fumigation, all of that stuff. In that time period, cocaine production increased by over 200%. And now there's plenty of cocaine to go around. There has been for a long time. So it was actually like kind of a huge realization in my like late, probably like early 20s, that all of this like righteous political socialization that I was experiencing could be applied to this thing that I had been doing on the side for so many years. And in many ways was an articulation, a true, like a more full articulation of that. But it took some time to be comfortable with that because I probably experienced some of the fear that comes with being public about like engaging with the alternative and with the underground and with drugs in particular. So all that to say that like the thing that led me to doing drug policy was, and I know much clearer now than it did then, was actually absolutely kind of grew out of that initial marginalization that I experienced as a younger person. And now it's so funny because what I've seen over the years is I really feel like Colombia in particular, because of its role in the drug war, and I think this is true of Mexico in many ways too, like created, like the drug war in Colombia created the people who I believe will dismantle the drug war in our generation, because nobody knows the pain like the people who are subject to the drug war in Colombia and Central and South America, and of course the people who have been subject to incarceration and racism and discrimination here in the United States. And in the same way that I was radicalized by my perceived mistreatment by the United States because of the surveillance on my communities and so on, I'm really seeing this generation, like you were describing, like myself and others, who know what's going on, see what's going on, and are like trying to step up to do something about it. And my decision to go to law school was absolutely inspired by and motivated by my desire to know exactly what language was being used to oppress me and my people and to justify the huge amounts of violence and money and weaponry that was utilized to eradicate people, families, crops, land for generations. So it was absolutely me being like, I need to know the language of quote unquote the oppressor or these people. And what you just described, like me kind of being in these conversations now, however many years later, it is because I needed to know what was going on and I just needed to see under the hood. And I say this openly because like I'm out here to dismantle the whole thing from the top to the bottom. And we can talk more about this later. And what I've learned over the years is that there's some people whose role is to dismantle. And I think some of that is mine. But some people have to be creating a place for people to go when the thing gets dismantled. And that's actually a little bit more of where my policy approach comes in, which is like, what is it that we're trying to create in the alternative? Because are you familiar with the concept of the just transition?
I'm not.
I think it maybe has other origins, but I originally experienced it in the concept of climate justice. The just transition is, I'm probably crudely describing it, but basically is the idea that if you're trying to create a paradigm that we can shift to, unless you're bringing everybody along, you're not really creating revolutions. Kind of this idea of it's not available to the poor, it's neither radical nor revolutionary. The future is here for the rich. It's kind of this kind of concept. And the original concept of the just transition, as I learned it, was around the oil economy. And it's like, yeah, we can go to solar, but who can go to solar? If you look at the quote-unquote developing world or the exploited world, everyone's on gas and coal because that's what's available to them. Even if we made the UN or every country made a mandate, we're going to move to solar. Like, there's not enough factories in the world to create solar to actually move all of the world's poor people, all of poverty, into like renewable energy right now. That's, you need a bridge to do that. So the just transition is you have to have a transition that is just to the most marginalized people. So I bring that into this concept of drug policy where it's like we can and should move as fast as we're able to transition away from the current system of prohibition and oppression and all that. But we have to have something to go to. So to me, the just transition as it applies to drug policy is like the bridge that allows everybody to cross it, like everybody to cross it. So when we get to the other side, we can burn that bridge, leave that behind, and we're not leaving people behind who will be our downfall in the next generation.
So in fashioning this just transition, it seems like ideally you would be able to workshop and iterate different mm-hmm. models in different places. Mm-hmm. But that's tricky with drug policy reform yeah. because, you know, we're talking about what's going on in Oregon right now. And what's come up again and again in this conference is like, we got to get this right, because if we get one big story about psilocybin mm-hmm. in Oregon, then it's going to disrupt yeah. efforts in Denver and California.
Knock the
elsewhere.
Whole house of cards down yeah. or whatever.
But at the same time, it seems completely unfeasible that with our human brains, we'll be able to like actually see the landscape and say, no, this is the policy. And then something mm-hmm. you yourself have said is that even if we were to nail what Oregon needs, mm-hmm. that's not going to work in Tennessee.
Right.
So when you're talking about the just transition, perhaps this can get us into some of your philosophy around legalization of psychedelics and the end of prohibition broadly. Let's be careful about the psychedelic totally. Exceptionalism.
Totally.
But perhaps this is a way we can get into your broader philosophy around this. How do we iterate a just transition mm-hmm. in such a sensitive political climate for drug policy reform?
Yeah, and where the stakes are very high.
So high.
Yeah, this is a question that I've sat with and continue to struggle with and think about literally every day. So there is a sense that is true that there is a level of urgency that needs to be applied. We were like 51 now years into the capital W, capital D war on drugs as we know it. The current global drug control system really started about 120 years ago in the late 1800s with the prohibition of opium on the West Coast because of the Chinese migrants in the United States. Therefore, the railroads, to the prohibition of cannabis, to what we now know as the war on drugs. So we're about 120 years into the current kind of drug control scheme, which, by the way, was highly motivated by the United States. Most of the European powers by the late 1800s were making bank off of selling drugs everywhere. So they were happy with the status quo. And it was really the U.S. and our own approach toward prohibition and temperance and a lot of other things that kind of led to that. And before that, I've talked about this a lot in other contexts, but I think that the war on drugs as we know it started with colonization, with initial suppression of indigenous cultural practices that involved plants and sacred kind of traditional cultural practices. So all that to say that like the stakes are really freaking high and they kind of fold into every aspect of society. It's really hard to find somewhere that's not touched by that. So I really get that urgency. Really, truly, like from the bottom of my heart. And working in policy and trying to understand how people operate and what's possible, kind of like what you're saying, our kind of, I don't know if you said this, but our puny human minds, we're like, how are we supposed to solve this problem that's been boiling for 500 years, is kind of like what you were describing, this idea that because we don't know exactly what we should do. I mean, like you said earlier, you get this like fluffy platitudes. Like there should be, I don't mean this to be diminishing, like there needs to be justice. Like, yeah, for sure. But like, what does that look like? Like, okay, maybe we can get to reparations or restoration or ecological or cultural restitution. Okay, that's a little bit more specific. How do we decide who and how? And like, so there's all these questions once you get to the technical thing. How do you actually make that happen in a way that's tangible enough for people to be like, yeah, let's do that. And we'll make a plan to do it. So where I've landed is, I guess, two things. One, this idea that because even though a lot of us have ideas, and I think some people may even have the right exact ideas, like because of the way humanity works and because you can't force someone, again, the just transition is also ideological. You can try to force someone into your ideological belief, but that will cause backlash. So I think that what I was describing in this kind of conversation, bringing it to Oregon and the state-by-state work that's happening in the U.S. and also the drug policy iteration around the world is like, we're going to try different things out. And they're going to move us away from prohibition and criminalization in a variety of ways. Some of them are going to come into contact with capitalism. We're going to have regulated, commercialized systems, like what you're kind of seeing with cannabis right now. And as we kind of iterate on that, even with the stakes being so high and the urgency being so real, I do feel like the process, which may feel slow and is slow in some ways, brings people along bit by bit by bit. And I was speaking with Bob Jesse before my talk yesterday, and he was saying that in one of the meetings of his kind of spiritual practice some years ago, someone said, slow change is permanent change. And there's a part of me, like my like activist part of me is like, it's too slow. Whatever.
Empty the jails now.
It's too slow. And part of me is like, okay, and even if I don't, this may be an incomplete explanation, but one kind of crude explanation for the Trump era was that it was a reaction to Barack Obama's 8 years, and that there was this kind of racial resistance that kind of bubbled up and created what we saw as the last kind of era of American politics. And whether or not that's totally true, and I think it could be to a certain extent, the idea is like when you move forward without all of the buy-in, then you're going to get some sort of backlash. And I don't know if it's two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward and two steps back. I don't really know. But with drug policy, and I can understand why people don't feel good about this, and maybe I'm not right about it, like, I do think this kind of iterative approach makes sense because we are trying to figure out something new. We're not, and I think I see this trap a lot, like, we're not actually just trying to go back to, like, a traditional indigenous or pagan earth-based way of knowing things, because we don't live in that world anymore. Capitalism, colonialism, industrialization has permanently changed the landscape. We are in the Anthropocene. We have changed the earth forever, at least for our lifetimes. So this idea that I've been cultivating kind of into this second phase is like, how do we harmonize the ongoing different policy approaches, which we can get into, religious, personal, medical, decriminal, like all these different things. There's been this kind of sense that you have to just like choose one and then move forward with it. And I'm really starting to become resistant to that, because I actually feel like if we're going to move forward in a just way where everyone comes along, you actually need multiple points of entry for different kinds of people for their own cosmology. Different people like you, as a person who was raised atheist, like you, without presuming anything, have been socialized into a particular cosmological understanding of reality. And maybe that's evolved over the course of your life through your own experiences. But different people are coming from their own kind of epistemological, ideological frameworks. And each of us, in some ways, needs to be taught or experienced or learned through that framework in order to grow. There's a certain way where if you approach someone, even with the best logic or the best whatever, like if it's not within their heuristic or their cosmology, then the framework, then it actually like not only probably won't work and you'll put a lot of effort in to do nothing, but it might even like calcify them in their own belief system. So all that to say that like this idea from a policy philosophy approach, I guess you could say for drug policy in particular with my own experience, has been this isn't a zero-sum game. We're all trying to figure this out together. Let's just like be humble about that and try, make room for failure, recognize the actual or perceived urgency, and give each other grace as we move forward. And people will continue to fall through the cracks until we, quote unquote, solve this problem. Like, we're not going to be able to save everyone. And that's a hard thing to say. It's a hard thing to feel. And it's a really hard thing to watch. But I haven't figured out another way to do it. I haven't figured out what the magic pill is. And it's definitely not psilocybin.
There's a bit of a trolley car problem.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's like we want to save everybody now. And I think particularly with the drug policy reform stuff, it's like we want to get people out of jail. Like we want to repair communities.
Yeah.
And we want that now because it's been a long time coming. And yet, if we stumble and we don't build proper coalitions and we're not able to test certain things because we really don't know the outcome. As Bob Jesse was saying, it's like psilocybin is not perfectly safe.
Right.
There will be and have been casualties in the medicalization of psychedelics or in any of these other ways in which psychedelics and plant medicine healing will become part of culture. So that tension between the sort of urgency of justice and the moving at the speed of trust and coalition building, that's a tension.
Yeah.
And I think a tension that's well to be named. And I don't envy you in having to hold it, but you do a good job of speaking to it. And I think that that in itself helps people who maybe have a particular activist cosmology align with a particular sort of medical cosmology. Mm-hmm. So I think this would be a great time for us to train up the audience on some of the key ways that psychedelic legalization or normalization will enter mainstream society. You and I both have experienced psychedelics in the underground. Mm-hmm. I, with a lot of privilege in terms of like, I've been able to do it. I've had access to it.
Yeah.
I think we both can agree that what we want to see is no one punished for cognitive liberty, period. Mm-hmm. And that these powerful medicines have their traditions honored, are able to themselves change the medical system of this country and the world, and ultimately are leading to the healing of cultures and societies. Mm-hmm. And you said something in a talk yesterday about how whole healed societies do not need to be coerced with laws. Mm-hmm. And that's speaking to regulation. But we're not in a whole-healed society.
Right.
And we're in this sort of jalopy of kind of trauma and goodwill, trying to drive this thing somewhere somewhere nice that we can all just trip and lay in a field.
Chill out for a bit.
So there are a couple of access points for changing the state of psychedelics and mind-altering substances generally. And so that's the decriminalization movement. That is the FDA approval for research. There's the FDA approval for the medicalization, which I know MAPS has really pushed that angle with the MDMA for veterans, which is a very strategic starting point. There's also the religious, ritual, spiritual use. And then what I just love, and I think we need to not forget to speak about, is just adult recreational use.
100%.
Would you say those are the big five? Am I missing any?
No, I think that's exactly right. I like framing recreational use as like just adult use.
Yeah,
because it can be
adult
a lot
use
of
for
things.
Anything. Yeah, it could be therapeutic if you want it to.
It could be a lot of things,
but
it
it's not a in a regulated therapeutic framework, for example, or a regulated spiritual access kind of thing.
Exactly. And it might be like regulated in the sense that there might be quality control. Like maybe in a perfect world, like whoever's figuring out where the drugs are getting sold, we're just making sure that the labels are accurate. In the same way that if you buy something off a shelf in the store, like, they're not going to tell you what kind of ham to put in your sandwich, but they're going to be like, has this been through like basic protocol to make sure that this won't make a gajillion people sick? So regulation is like a massive category. But yes, I would say that's more or less accurate. And actually, one tiny caveat or correction that I would make is it is true that the political strategy and the conversation, and certainly the media around MDMA therapy for PTSD has focused on veterans. But I do like to name that in our studies so far, I actually think the vast majority of people who've participated in them, even though this isn't as visible in the media, have been victims of child abuse or sexual assault.
So, which can make PTSD more intractable.
Absolutely.
It's super interesting. So you have people who are veterans of conflicts, but they are less resilient to that experience if they've had adverse childhood experiences.
I don't know about the numbers exactly off the top of my head, but I imagine that there's a much larger number of people who have adverse childhood experiences than have served in the military. Of course, there's a lot of overlap. I'm not saying that it's one or the other, but there are a lot of people who fall out together. But yeah, besides that, that's the range for now, at least.
Okay, so we've got these five approaches. And what you were saying earlier is that it's not about choosing one horse. It's about kind of moving them together forward in different ways.
Right.
Can you give a brief summary of each of these and where we're at with them from a legal standpoint?
Yes. Let's see if I can do it in 5 minutes, a minute each. So I'll start with decriminalization because it's my favorite.
Why is it your favorite?
Because to me, I mean, there's a lot of ways that drug policy and the current drug control scheme has hurt people. But I think the insult to injury is criminalization for what you put in your own body. To me, like on a very, very basic fundamental human right level, the fact that governments are criminalizing individuals for that choice of what they're putting in themselves feels like in some ways more fundamental, or at its most fundamental of all of these topics that we're talking about, which are all very important. But I think decriminalization is the thing that feels in some ways the most aligned with my core kind of values, because it cuts to kind of what you were describing, like the freedom of choice or the sovereignty of an individual to choose what they put in themselves. And I guess like in the way that we don't, as far as I know, criminalize people who drink bleach, you know, you shouldn't do that. But in fact, maybe it's encouraged by a former president, but I don't know of any criminal penalties for someone who decides to drink bleach, even though it's obviously toxic and bad for you. So the idea that you can be criminalized for that, for a choice of eating a mushroom which grows in the ground, is mind-boggling. So with decriminalization, I mean, there's a lot to be said. And going back to your kind of point about psychedelic exceptionalism, which again could be its own conversation, at its core, kind of going to this idea that the most, let's say, the kind of acute visible injustice is really articulated in this concept of mass incarceration and drug crimes, and not just mass incarceration, but really just all of this kind of criminality, criminal penalties. And I think that the broader move to decriminalize all drugs, or really like any substance that you put in your body, is actually less about the drugs and it's more about like this fundamental human right thing that I was just talking about. So there's a lot of ways that that's articulated. That we're in Oregon right now, Measure 110, which was passed in November 2020 with 58% of the vote of Oregonians, basically was the first place in the United States to attempt to decriminalize the personal use of not all, but most substances, not just the psychedelics, but also heroin and cocaine and I think maybe even methamphetamine, and not every single drug, but a lot. And that is kind of in the footsteps of this kind of move that Portugal went through about, I think, probably
2003.
Yeah, exactly. To decriminalize the personal use of all drugs, kind of in response to what they were experiencing as like an injection drug epidemic, not just the use, but like the Hep C and the HIV and the kind of secondary effects of what kind of large scale injection drug use. So decriminalization is like, that's the state that we've got. That's the example we've got. The key thing about 110 for the audience is that the angle that was taken was not, we're going to decriminalize drugs. It's treatment, not jail. We're going to, the other thing that Measure 110 did is allocate like almost $300 million to recovery centers around the state. So there's this idea like, oh, this is a medical problem, not a criminal one. And that's a little bit of a reductive framework itself, but it's definitely progress. So it's like, okay, yeah, maybe we can agree that we shouldn't criminalize this behavior. Let's move it into what we see as kind of like a public health frame. So, and you're seeing a lot of movement at this municipal level, cities, DC or Oakland, Denver, San Francisco, others, to deprioritize. This is maybe too nuanced for this conversation, but cities do not have the jurisdiction to determine whether or not drugs are criminalized in their city. That job is done by the state. So the state is the entity that enforces most drug laws in most states. There's also federal drug laws, but the reason I bring that up is because there's a lot of deprioritization. So city governments are saying, we want to make enforcing these certain drug laws around psilocybin or whatever the lowest law enforcement priority. So cops, basically, if there's anything else they could possibly do, they have to do that before they do this. And that was, as far as I know, there may be older, but I think that the first jurisdiction to do that was actually, before psychedelics, was actually Oakland in maybe like 2003 with cannabis. And I think there was actually even a deprioritization in Oregon here in like the 70s. Earl Blumenauer, who's still a state representative, who also spoke here yesterday at the conference yesterday, was really involved in that process like from the very beginning. So that's decriminalization and deprioritization. The second you talked about, which I would actually maybe put these two together, which is the kind of federal approach that's both for research and medical use. And what that's looked like is kind of twofold. One, as you described, approval through the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, so that any of these drugs can be prescribed as a medicine, which has tremendous secondary effects.
Does that automatically lead to descheduling if that were to happen on the federal level?
Oh, I love this question. The short answer is no, because of this legal fiction called bifurcated scheduling, where, and you see this with cannabis, where cannabis, which has multiple derivatives, synthetic and otherwise, that are currently approved medicines by FDA, dronabinol, marinol, Epidiolex, which are on like, I think, schedule 3, 3, and 5 or something like that, while marijuana, cannabis stays in schedule 1. Now, how can a drug that clearly has medical value stay in schedule 1 if we've proven that it's not? What happens is that, again, this is pretty nuanced, but what the FDA approves is not a drug, it's a drug product. And the definition, the term of art, drug product, means a drug plus all of the restrictions that FDA puts on its manufacture. So what that means is that the drug product of dronabinol, which is, I think, a THC, like a synthetic THC, and marinol is another good example, is in schedule whatever, but cannabis is still in schedule one. So again, this is a bit like policy wonk nuance, but what that means is that what we think is going to happen is that after prospective FDA approval, MDMA as a unique molecule would not be descheduled. The new MDMA drug product, which is just MDMA in a particular colored capsule with a particular manufacturing process, would be in a schedule other than schedule one. So not technically, but that's why, going back to the decrim thing, the medical route is actually insufficient to achieve what you could call justice within this. Like, it's a huge piece. It allows for prescribing, and key thing, it potentially allows for insurance coverage, which is a huge, huge factor in America, which is in a private insurance system, which again, is its own rabbit hole. But all that to say that I would say the research and the medical use are kind of in the same boat, because not entirely true, but a lot of the research so far has been in the interest of creating some sort of medical pathway. That's becoming less true, I think, in a good way. There's more research that's about other things, which is super exciting to see. But they've been kind of conflated, and they've been kind of on a similar track for a really long time. And as I mentioned in my talk yesterday here at Horizons, earlier this year and over the course of last year, the National Institute of Health, the NIH, for the first time really started allocating funds towards seeking out information about the beneficial use of these substances. Historically, for the last like 50 years, the National Institute of Drug Abuse has allocated millions and millions and millions of dollars toward finding the negative effects of drugs. So the fact that you have U.S. federal agencies and institutions funding research to see the positive effects is a massive big deal, and also huge. Someone working at, you know, working at MAPS, which has been entirely funded by philanthropy so far. The idea that like we have to just sit here and like wait for crumbs for the government while it has to be private donors who cover this is a little bit absurd, where we're like, we have the evidence. Why isn't the government pursuing this option? So that's the kind of FDA medical route. And there's a lot we could go down there. But going on to the next, which is kind of the religious and spiritual use, this is a really interesting one because the US, as we know, was founded ostensibly on the kind of framework of like religious freedom. And de facto, it's a little bit more complex, certainly now with the amount of, you know, money in politics and incredible influence that large religious organizations have in the US. But in short, there are three churches right now that very clearly have the rights to use their entheogenic sacrament in the US. The first is the Native American Church, working with peyote. That was like a 100-year fight, you could say, that kind of culminated in 1993. 92 with the Supreme Court case, and then 93 with the passing of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which kind of created that protection for Native American people to work with peyote specifically in their context. The other two churches are both ayahuasca churches, and you might have heard Biel Abate earlier talk about how these churches are they're syncretic churches. So they're ayahuasca churches that are really through the framework of Christianity in many ways.
And are they both Santo Daime?
Santo Daime is one of them, and the other one is UDV, Unidad de Vegetal. But they're both very similar in the sense that these syncretic churches. And it's a very tragic irony that those churches not only have legal protection in Brazil, but also the United States, while indigenous practices, both in Brazil and in the U.S., remain unprotected, for ayahuasca in particular. So what's happening right now is like this expansion of awareness around what kind of groundwork those cases set, what they do protect, what they don't. And as I'm sure you've seen, I'm sure your audience has definitely seen and heard, if not experienced themselves, a massive expansion of access to and interest in these sacred plant practices. Ayahuasca is a really good example because it's one of the few substances that got globalized, that kind of broke out of the jungle, you could say, with its traditional use. You'll see tons of neo-shamanism, tons of like hybrid use of stuff.
I do see tons of neo-shamanism.
It's all over the place. It's all over this. But in a beautiful way, ayahuasca is rarely used like by oneself in a totally recreational or like kind of off the wall context. It's almost always used in a ceremonial context, which is kind of unique to other substances that have been globalized and moved around. So what that means is that in the US, you have this kind of increasing self-organization of churches who don't fall within the protected categories that I mentioned earlier, that are like, what are the ways that we get protected? And how do we make sure that our right to utilize this in a spiritual context is protected? So we can go way more down that rabbit hole. But last but not least, when you're talking about adult recreational use or adult use broadly, that's really the closest thing to what you could compare to Measure 109 in Oregon, which is a non-medical, and this is a little bit niche, but I think you might appreciate it. When I say non-medical versus like an adult use, in this case, there's a lot of factors, but the primary factor, in my opinion, that differentiates those two things is that for a medical use, you have to have a diagnosis. Your diagnosis is like your key into the system. You kind of see it as a floor. It's like you have to have at least that, and then from there you can access medical services. An adult use, or maybe like a wellness or even a recreational system, would be the opposite. It'd have a ceiling where if you have certain contraindications, you would not be permitted. So under 109, every adult 21 or over is presumed permitted to participate in the program unless they're medically contraindicated. So in that sense, there's no diagnosis indication. And in fact, it's the opposite. You can't justify services based on a diagnosis. So that's like that regulated adult use. And this is like, trying to think of a good example. There really aren't that many in the world. Like there's a few that come close, but really that's like the, for lack of a better, less crude framing, it's kind of like the storefront dispensary approach, where it's like, if you're an adult, you show your ID, maybe in the future you have to go through like an educational session, or you have to prove that you've like read something about it, or you have to talk to a counselor so they know that you're educated on the risks. But that's the idea that like, these are things, these are substances, they're everywhere. People should have the right to at least try them in their own context. Again, going back to this like right to decide what you put in yourself. And that is kind of like a, it's not quite a middle ground, but it's kind of in some ways, if you look at it as a Venn diagram, it kind of like looks a little bit like the middle of spiritual use, which is really like community use with a particular like lens. Medical use, which is kind of more in a regulated like treatment context, and decriminalized use, which to me is like kind of like the open road where it's to say like people get to decide for themselves how they navigate that. So that's kind of, I just threw a lot at you, but that's kind of the 101 guide to all of those pieces. We can go into any details, but that's like a good kind of overview of some of that.
Yeah, no, it's a great overview, and I think it sets the stage well to speak about 109.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had someone who suggested that I do a podcast on what's happening in Oregon.
Yeah.
And what they said is they were like, people are going to drive up to Oregon and do mushrooms.
Yeah.
They get to drive up to Oregon and do mushrooms. And your listeners are going to want to know about that and how it works and what they're doing. And it is not as simple as that, of course. Mm-hmm. But what we have now is we have a statewide piece of legislation.
Yeah.
And it has already passed. It's going to be implemented on January 1st. Now, whether it effectively comes into action on January 1st, I'm not sure whether structures are in place that on January 1st, drive up to Oregon. It is specific to psilocybin, yes? It's only psilocybin. Yes.
And actually, because of the rules, it looks like it's actually going to be, at least for the first year, going to be specific to one particular mushroom that produces psilocybin.
Okay, so we just get one.
Yeah.
We just, which mushroom do we get?
Psilocybe cubensis, everyone's favorite golden
teachers. Don't get penis envies.
Not yet.
Which is always, always thought that was a bit of a strange name.
Not yet, same.
For a spiritual tool. But this is really groundbreaking because we're talking about, you know, decrim in Denver, Oakland, San Francisco. That's really deprioritization. SB 519 ended up getting defanged and kind of thrown out before it moved through. Like all the work went in and didn't happen.
Yeah.
But what's happening in Oregon is game changing. And what that means is first of all, fuck yeah, great. Mm-hmm. We're doing something.
Definitely.
And stakes are high because the world is watching. I know Colorado has its own bill that it's looking at, and maybe it might be worth touching on that because in terms of the application, I guess if Colorado's bill passes in the fall, it might go into effect at the same time. I don't know if it has the same.
I can go into all these details.
Yeah. So this is a big question.
Yeah.
And I think what it comes down to is for your regular psychedelic user, and indeed for your regular psychedelic user who would love their family member who's going through end-of-life anxiety. Mm-hmm. Let's take that for an example, you know, because I love tripping in the woods. But like, what about, can we drive up to Oregon and have the spiritual experience that we want to have? And what does that look like? Give me the 30,000 view.
Yeah, totally. So first off, because you said I do have to touch on California on 519 briefly.
Yeah.
Just because I am in California myself, I imagine some of your listeners might be in California. I just want to say that. So one key distinction between what you just described is that in Oregon, 109, which passed again in November 2020 with 56% of the vote, the Natural Medicine Health Act, which is scheduled to be on the ballot in November in Colorado this year, 2022, both of those went through the ballot initiative process, which in one sentence is when a bill is written and then you campaign to put it directly on the ballot. So voters decide. So it's a voter yes, no vote. It's a yes, no voter determined vote. It's very different than going through the legislature, which is where you have to deal with a lot of there's politics in all of it, but it's certainly the place where a lot of good ideas go to die, or at least that's the cynical view of kind of legislatures. That's not always true. But so I say that to say that in California, Senator Scott Wiener and I don't even know, probably like a month, maybe even less than a month after 109 passed, sent out a tweet, which I found out later kind of surprised not just us, but even like maybe his own staffers and other people, where he was just like, we're going to do this in California. We're going to move forward on psychedelics. And we were like, whoa. And also, awesome. Let's do this.
Sounds like a groovy dude from San Francisco.
Exactly.
We're doing it here. Exactly. We waited too long.
Exactly. And there's a whole arc. And maybe if there's resources I can share with you and your audience, there's some good podcasts, longer conversations that I've had just about 519. But in short.
Yeah, let's do that. Send me some stuff that I'll put in the show notes because there's a lot of stuff we're touching on today.
Yeah.
So what we'll have is we'll have some links in the show notes where we can go deeper. And I'll just put a little note about that. So if you're listening, now you want to go deeper, that'll be in the show notes.
Perfect. Thank you. And basically, like a number of people in a coalition across California supported Senator Wiener's office in drafting and building support for a bill that would have just decriminalized the personal use of 7 psychedelics. That was what it was. And I just bring that up to say that, like, again, there's more to say there, but that went through the legislative process, which was in some ways really amazing for me because it was my first like real super close contact with the state legislature, especially in my home state. And it was also heartbreaking because the political process is as nasty as people think it is. And even though we were talking about psychedelics, and in some ways that makes it awesome, there's no question that like the, whatever they call it, what's the phrase they use? Like the sausage making process is quite horrific. So anyway, so going back to what you were saying about Oregon and Colorado. So I'll actually start with Colorado because I can touch on that quickly, and then I'll go to your bigger question about Oregon.
And with Colorado, so this is something that's going to be voted on this fall.
By the voters in November 2022.
November. So yeah, let's just touch on that. If we have any Colorado listeners, maybe just let's throw a note in about how we can help persuade Colorado voters about that, because it is present.
It's huge. And one key thing is that 109, which I'll talk more about in a second, it is a regulated psilocybin services program. So it's a fairly highly regulated, the bill is 78 pages long, fairly highly regulated system, which has like specific licenses for like manufacturers and cultivators and facilitators and service centers that kind of create like a, you could say, a closed ecosystem within Oregon for like how the services operate. Colorado, the bill in Colorado anticipates doing something very similar that would, like Oregon, go through a 18-month to two-year-long kind of planning pre-implementation process where they're like panels and subcommittees spend a lot of time on a lot of details to figure out what exactly does this look like. So going to your question about whether or not it'll be ready on Gen 1, some things for sure will, because I've been on the social equity subcommittee in Oregon, have been in meetings probably every other week for the last 18 months on a lot of the pre-questions around like what does it look like when you have a regulated system. So Colorado's regulated system, like Oregon's, would theoretically go into effect 2 years after passing. But the key difference in Colorado is that it also decriminalizes the personal use of a number of these substances, including not just psilocybin, but also ibogaine, DMT, and mescaline, not from PRD.
So decrim is part of the bill in
Colorado. Yes, in Colorado.
And so, it's not in Oregon.
Correct. Which I have feelings about. It's a whole thing. But in short, the other very interesting key difference is that in Colorado, 2 years after the implementation starts, the possibility of incorporating those substances, those three other substances, ibogaine, DMT, and mescaline, again, not from peyote specifically, all could be included in the future regulated system in Colorado. So it's a bit more like expansive and kind of brings in other elements. So we can come back to that. Going back to Oregon, to your original question, unfortunately, there isn't a super clear answer. So we're recording this in what, like September? Are we in September?
September 18th.
September 18th, 2022. And the draft rules, so after many months of meetings, 109 created the OPAB, the Oregon Psilocybin Advisory Board, which creates recommendations that they send to the Oregon Health Authority, OHA. OHA is the entity within Oregon that actually regulates the whole program. So the OPAB, Oregon Psilocybin Advisory Board, and its many subcommittees, of which I'm on one, have been meeting for the last 18 months to sort through damn near every detail you can probably imagine and a lot you can't think, like most people can't think of, around how do you do this? What mushrooms do you use? Where can they grow? Like how much do people get to take? What does the labeling look like? Who can buy it? Where does it come from? Like every detail, definitely not every. All the ones that we've been able to think of so far have been engaged with quite extensively by a number of people, experts, regulators, the public, over a long time. And the draft rules, the Oregon Health Authority just released its draft rules. So the first draft of the rules after 18 months of engagement, maybe I think more than that actually at this point, are out as of a week ago and will be iterated on. There's going to be a public comment period. There's going to be people who submit direct comments, including maps. We're going to be reviewing and figuring out what our thoughts are about it. We'll submit something in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. So the short answer to your question is like about whether or not you can go on January 1st, 2023 and do mushrooms in Oregon legally is kind of an I don't know. My understanding is that right now there is not a requirement that to participate in the program you have to be an Oregon resident. To participate in the regulated system, like if you want to get a license to be part of the industry, you could say, in Oregon, there is a two-year residency requirement. But I do anticipate, and I think Oregonians also thinking about the program, do anticipate Oregon being what people call like a kind of psychedelic tourism hotspot in a few years. So we won't really know until the final rules are out, which I think will be at the end of this year. But you will definitely start to see people getting trained to be facilitators. And there's already people that are seeking like space for, land for, and kind of commercial real estate in some cases to create like service centers. So you'll see the big groundwork of that. You're kind of already seeing it now. But as far as when exactly will you be able to start to get trained, it kind of remains to be seen. And there will, of course, be a lag because there has to be people that get trained through the program as it exists within the regulated system before anyone can receive facilitation from one of these facilitators. So, you know, I would say by like spring, summer 2023, like at least some stuff will be online. And I think that exactly the details of who gets to do it and how and so on, I think does remain to be seen with this final kind of, it's a rules advisory committee, this kind of rulemaking process. And if, you know, your audience does get a chance to see some of the videos that are from Horizons, which I do believe will be posted online at some point, may or may not be out by the time this comes out, you can see how the Oregon Health Authority and folks who've been involved in these subcommittees have been in a, I would say, like a very extensive, you know, you can critique a lot of things in every direction, but a very, very thorough, to the extent that's possible, process of figuring out what exactly do we want this to look like for the first time.
So we've gone quite deep, but hardly deep at all, considering the subject matter.
So many things.
And I think the best way for our listeners to move forward is actually to tap into those resources that you'll share with me. So what I'll do is, in the show notes, we'll have some like continued listening with a little note about, you know, what it is, that people can have a sense like, okay, we've touched on this broader perspective of psychedelic legalization. What's going on in Oregon?
Can I say one more thing about the policy stuff before?
Give me some policy stuff.
Because actually it's about policy, but it's also about entrepreneurship.
Great.
And about like social engagement. And I just want to say one last thing after saying all that. And there's, like you said, so many resources to go into. But I do want to say one thing, which is just because I see this a lot. And I imagine that maybe some of your listeners are part of this conversation. But a lot of people, whether it's because they do psychedelics for the first time or really start to utilize them in a healing or kind of personal growth expansion way besides just partying with them, and or come into contact with like the psychedelic ecosystem, which is my word for the industry, the underground, and everything in between and everything around it, including traditional use, including all these practices. I find that a lot of people believe that once they're like energized and excited about the fact that there's something happening, you can actually do something in this way, which is really, really inspiring. I think that there's a tendency, or I've seen a tendency to, and it's kind of the classic thing, it's like, I got to drop everything and go to this other thing. I got to like leave my house and live in a van. I got to quit my job or do this. And for a long time, it was just like you'd quit your job and be benign and maybe become an artist. And now it's like everyone's quitting the job and wanting to become a psychedelic entrepreneur because they think that to give back, they have to like do something through their paradigm, business or entrepreneurship or whatever. And one thing that I just really want to say is there's certainly ways to contribute in that. I'm not kind of undermining that. But what I believe would actually have the most impact on this, besides just civic engagement, educating your representatives and just being part of the conversation, is actually realizing that it's not just psychedelics that need a new economic paradigm for this future or whatever industry, however you want to call it. It's actually the whole world. It's every aspect of economics. It's every aspect of everything. So what I've been urging people to do is, instead of dropping everything and running into wherever, I could name specific countries or places, but I won't because it's a little bit complex. But I'll just say, if instead of like dropping and unplugging from the US experiment, which is a massive privilege, I just want to say that, like a lot of people who like dip and go to wherever else to start the retreat center or whatever, it's a massive privilege to do that. And it's a huge responsibility if you're going to be like, I'm not going to participate in the cultural environment that I was raised in and that my ancestors helped create. When I see people who are like American, especially white Americans, who leave to do whatever they want, I'm like, okay, like that's what you're doing. But you are leaving behind something. Not you personally. I'm not putting that blame on an individual. But I really see that there's a duty that we have as Americans with a massive privilege and resources compared to the global South to change what's going on here, which will have reverberative effects in other places. So I guess my call, I don't like the phrase call to action, but like what I'm saying here is, if you're in an industry, if you're in a space, you've developed an expertise, you've developed a reputation and a thing in the environment that you're in, I would rather people who are in real estate, who do psychedelics, to work to changing real estate. I would rather people who are in finance who do psychedelics to work to change finance. We don't need more people who are thinking about psychedelic finance. They need to be changing finance. So I really want people to bring these like amazing expansive things and these visionary things that they're bringing to their own context. Like, we need people everywhere. We don't need like a more, I mean, of course we want more people in the psychedelic ecosystem specifically, but if we concentrate all of the benefits of psychedelics within like our own little like economic ecosystem, then we're actually going to watch the rest of the world crumble while maybe we create an island of awesomeness temporarily. So I just want to really urge people, like, look at where you are. This is the same thing with reciprocity, which we don't need to go into, but reciprocity is about, where are you relative to what's going on around you? And like, I really want people to see, like, where are they with their own positionality, with their own resources, and how do they, from that position, change what's going on around them instead of having to escape and leave and do something that they think is new and visionary. So I just had to say that because I just see it a lot.
Well, it's a great call to action, or perhaps even a call to maybe inaction.
Yeah, kind of.
But what it is it's a kind of psychedelic humility, which I think is, the silver bullet is not psilocybin, but the silver bullet is psychedelic humility in the context of these changes. Yeah. And this brings me to my favorite thing, my favorite sentence or two from your Double Blind article. Mm. And I think actually it's going to tie the whole thing together.
Oh, I love it.
And based on your experience with Islam, based on the diligent work you're doing with policy, based on this moving at the speed of trust, and as kind of an antidote or a counterbalance to the ontological addiction of chasing peak experiences, you wrote, "This foundation of a way of peace layered with cosmic visionary experiences, has shown me that mysticism is more than just a peak state. Rather, it is an art that can be cultivated through being in relation. In a way, it is a submission to the diligent and gentle tempo of ordinary life. From being with the land, to cooking its bounty, to nourishing, to celebrating, to praying, to mourning. People chasing peak experiences seem to miss this part, bypassing the daily practice of integrating and weaving the wisdom gleaned from our higher selves into the tapestry of our lives, our families, and our communities. It's the work. Mm-hmm. And it's not always sexy because it's the work of ordinary life. Mm-hmm. And what you were just saying about this idea of, I need to go be a psychedelic entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there's a way to ingest some kind of aspirational quality mm-hmm. to ordinariness mm-hmm. in the context of the psychedelic movement and its enormous power for mm-hmm. not only healing, but for really bringing communities together and mm-hmm. and play and all the wonderful things that mm-hmm. it brings. Because I think the hype
yeah.
may be its downfall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's so much in that. And I came to that sentence that you just read or sentences like through a lot of, I don't know if forced is the way, but certainly like humility that I didn't necessarily seek out. I think that, and people who have been working with psychedelics for a long time know that every once in a while you just get your ass kicked by yourself or by the universe or however you want to frame it. And yeah, it's actually just to connect a lot of these dots, like it was actually learning that part of some interpretations of Sufi mystical practice is not, and this is what I was saying earlier, is not asceticism. It's not escaping from society. It's actually like a full engagement with it, which to me is the mundane. It's like we are in a world with like a material reality that is tragic and complex and like kind of boring and like compared to maybe our rich, expansive internal experiences. And to me, that like sentence or this practice of cultivating the mundane is not becoming a wallflower and floating into the background and just being your like worker bee self, you know, and like the larger corporate whatever. It's actually engaging with life as a place of great potential from our human perspective and perception and willingness to engage with it. So it's kind of a paradox in the sense that what I say is mundane is actually like bringing the visionary thing into the day to day and coming back all the way around. This is why I really love what you're doing with Life as a Festival, because what I understand your framing and certainly how I've experienced it is this idea that we're actually like creating the world that we want to live in, like around ourselves as we live it. Last night we were at the after party for Horizons and I was with hanging out with Alixa Garcia, who's one of the members of Climbing Poetry who performed last night and who DJed and who's just a dear friend. And we were talking about this. And I was thinking about this quote and mentioned this quote that I've always heard attributed to John Gilmore. If you want to change the world, throw a better party.
Mm.
And the idea is like you don't change the world by like coercing people or shaming people into changing their ways. You actually attract them. It's a magnetism. You want them to do it. And eventually it's them doing it themselves. You're not pushing them. And Alixa said, she said, changing the world is the party. She's like, what we're doing, I just got goosebumps. What we're doing, we were like out there last night sweating, dancing, like really like in the vortex, right? After like this really academic and wonderful, but super dense conference. And she's like, changing the world like is the party. She's been in the movement space and eco justice, food justice, permaculture, so many racial justice, drug policy for 20 plus years, her and Climbing Poetry and that kind of scene. And I was just like, I looked at her and I was like, dude, because like, yeah, the real party follows us around, not because like we're so cool. It's because we're actually trying to live in the world that we're trying to create. And also bringing this all the way back around, the reason this comes back to queerness actually is because part of the experience of creating the world that we want to live in, like as it's happening, also has to do with this foundational sense of safety that I think when I think queerness, I also think not just the evolving thing, but also the sense, the lack of safety. And the desire to seek safety, not just in an identity, but in a community. And I really have learned that I feel safest, even in these like, whether it's a political or philanthropic or with super rich people or super powerful, like my sense of safety is cultivated in my sense of knowing this, like groundedness, what you were saying, like confidence on stage. That's because like I feel really clear about who and what I'm accountable to after years of practice. And that is my family. That is my community. That's the people. I'm about to get emotional right now because it's like, it's the people who made it possible for me to be who I am, to like do this. Like it's not me. It's like all of these things that have led to the trajectory and momentum to like make it possible for me to have that confidence like on stage, which is just like one tiny iteration of that. So I'm like out here to like throw a better party and like bring us all along and like turn life into a festival, not because it has to be an escape from what we're trying to be, but because it's actually where we're supposed to be going, where we've supposed to be the whole time. So the rest of this is a distraction. So it's like, how do we cut through it with like what we really want? The celebration, the joy, and the mourning, and the death, and the change, like all of that all at once. Yeah.
So good. What a beautiful ending. Great job.
Yeah.
Where can people find more of you now that they have fallen in love with you in this conversation? where can people follow you? Where are you putting out stuff? We'll have links to the Horizon stuff, of course. Obviously, we'll have links to maps. Mm-hmm. I know that you have a couple other projects. Just give us the spaces we can know about you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for this conversation, Eamon. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Sage, S-A-G-E underscore Izzy, Sage Izzy. And I'm not the most prolific poster, but it's where you can kind of follow things off and on. It's like semi-personal, semi-professional. My like professional home is Maps, where I do my policy and advocacy work full time. You can follow Maps on social media at Maps or at Maps News, depending on its Instagram or Twitter. There's tons of stuff. I really encourage people to go to the website and you can get a lot of downloads on a lot of substances and politics and communications, amazing stuff that's on that website. There's a lot there. I'm also a co-founder for the Psychedelic Bar Association, which is a bar association for attorneys that are interested in psychedelics, both from a content learning perspective, but also from a, like a patterns and practice perspective. So looking at how legal professionals actually shape the ecosystems that they're in and learning to take responsibility of that, and not in like an egoic way, but because in many ways law is a service industry, but in a way that actually takes responsibility for the incredible influence that, going back to the very first question we had here, the like archaic language of the law that has been like calcified in all these ways. Lawyers are the ones who are trained to work with it. Like it's our responsibility to, as we're doing in this conversation, educate people about it and make it easier to understand. So the Psychedelic Bar Association, you can find it at thepsychedelicbar.org. It's open to membership for legal professionals and we'll be doing events and pushing out stuff over time. I'll also actually throw a shout out for Psychedelic Science 2023, which will be MAPS' giant full city Denver takeover in June 2023. It'll be really fun. It'll be a conference, concerts, events, all kinds of workshops, all kinds of fun stuff. It'll be a really huge, potentially the largest psychedelic conference style gathering as far as we know, certainly in modern times, maybe in history within this iteration of the Renaissance. And then last but not least, I work with a number of other organizations, including Chacruna Institute, which is www.chacruna.net, which is a phenomenal resource for a lot of information about psychedelics. If you want to go way deep into way too many topics, that's the place to go. It really has like a huge wealth of information on policy, culture, politics, art, music, religion, all of these, spirituality, all these different topics. They do a lot of amazing conferences as well, have a lot of books. And I'm also currently on the board of directors of Sage Institute in Oakland, which is a nonprofit community health clinic working with psychedelic therapy on the ground. So if you're local to the Bay Area, definitely check them out. Always seeking donations. All that money will go to psychedelic care for queer, trans, BIPOC folks all in the Bay Area. And if you're a legal professional, check out the Psychedelic Bar Association. If you're literally anybody, check out MAPS. Feel free to follow me on the internet. And I think that's probably it for now.
You do so much. You do so much good work in the world. Ismail, what a pleasure.
Yeah.
What a pleasure. This has been beautiful. And I always know a great podcast because if it didn't really land, I feel very tired afterwards. And if I'm feeling really energized and like pumped and yeah, I want to get back to this conference and I want to like talk to people, I know that we had some magic here and we had lots of magic here today. So thanks for taking the time during a busy conference weekend. So great to learn more about you and know more about this beautiful movement of both healing and expression and community and play that is the unleashing of psychedelics. And may the queerness as well be unleashed. All of it.
It's in it, whether we like it or not. So yeah, thank you, Eamon, really, really so much for the time. I don't know if we said this at the beginning, but for the listeners, like, Eamon and I have been trying to have this conversation for literally 2 years. We've like almost met up like in the Bay and in Mexico and like probably four other places that we've like almost seen each other. We keep seeing each other. We keep saying we're going to do it. So I just really appreciate that we were both so persistent.
It's the main reason I came up here.
Yeah, I'm so grateful.
So
I'm so grateful. I'm so glad we made it work
out. Yeah, and it's the right place for it.
So. Hell yeah. We're like in cloudy Portland as the world turns and changes around us. Like, what better place to be?
Great job.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.